You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a representative of the Wisconsin Hospital Association joins the show to tell us why the organization supports a new bill that would ban white bagging, a practice where insurance companies only cover medications, often at hospitals, only if patients use specific pharmacies. Now, Veterans Day is around the corner, and the Wisconsin Veterans Museum is exploring how veterans remember their time serving. Their new exhibit opening next week is called Souvenirs of Service. It showcases the things that Wisconsin vets and their families kept from their time serving as far back as the Civil War and as recent as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Kevin Hampton is the curator of history at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Really interesting sounding exhibit. Can you talk about the idea of using these souvenirs as a window into the stories behind them?
Certainly. I mean, I think souvenirs are a very relatable item. You know, we all have walked past a gift shop somewhere, whether it's in an airport or at the Dells, and we've all seen those, you know, magnets or the postcards. And it's this human impulse across time that we want to document the places that we've been, the people that we've known, the events in our lives that have some of the most meaningful components to our life story. So it is a natural way for humans to document their own stories, and it's no different for service members. And looking at their stories through what they choose to collect is very important.
And some of the objects you have are way more unique than any postcard I've ever sent, Kevin. I want to examine a couple of them, starting with a nylon dress. This is an incredible story. Can you share this one?
Sure, certainly. So the nylon dress is actually made out of what, you know, we would call parachute silk. Many people would see it. It's going to be a nice, beautiful white dress when you walk into the exhibit, and you might think it's a wedding dress, but it's actually, it's not. It's an evening gown. And the unique story for this one is actually that it comes from Lieutenant Floyd Steiner. In November of 1944, he's flying in a B-29 with the 40th Bomb Group, and as they're approaching their target city over Japan, they actually are... the plane is hit several times, but they managed to keep the B-29 airborne long enough to cross the China Sea and bail out over Japanese-occupied territory in eastern China. And after being rescued by local farmers and smuggled back to safety, he actually mails that life-saving parachute that he jumped from the B-29 with back to his wife in Eau Claire and requests that she use the material to make a dress for herself. And it's fascinating because if you look at how a parachute is constructed, you'll notice that there's, of course, there's a lot of parachute ropes and lines that are also used in the construction of this dress. And she actually carefully took apart each seam of fabric and reused it for her own gown design, and then actually got an experienced dressmaker as well as a rug maker to teach her how to braid the shoulder straps out of the parachute cord. And so she had this evening dress completed in 1945 and took a portrait of her wearing it and mailed it off to her husband, who was still serving in India at the time.
I got to ask, Kevin, how do you find stories like this and get people to come forward and share these artifacts with you?
It's really an opportunity for us to talk to the families. And we always, whenever I talk to the families, I always say, we want to get to know the person. We want to get to know your loved one, or in this, if it's a veteran themselves, we want to get to know you and tell us about you. A lot of people think of us as, you know, a military history museum, so you want the dress uniforms and you want the typical ephemera of war, but really we want to capture the person. We want to find those unique stories that make it personal. So it's really an opportunity for us to talk to the families about what's your favorite memory? What's your favorite experience? What can you tell us about these individuals if they've passed or if they're not there? Or if it's the veteran themselves, it's even better because we get the story firsthand.
I want to check out another artifact at your exhibit opening next week at the Veterans Museum, a Civil War era cannonball that somebody decided to cart back home to Wisconsin with them?
Yes, this is one of the little more morbid, if you will, souvenirs. This is actually the artillery shell that killed the second person from Wisconsin in the Civil War in July of 1861. So the company is the La Crosse Light Guard out of La Crosse. And they're under fire for the first time at the Battle of the skirmish at Blackburn's Ford before the first Battle of Bull Run. And as they're under artillery fire, the shell comes passing through their lines and kills Myron Gardner of La Crosse. And he actually he dies a few hours later. But the men of the company about 20 minutes after this projectile lands in their lines, decide that they really want to bring this piece home. So they actually send someone back 20 yards behind them and picks this shell up off the ground and brings it back to the front lines. And they even write a few weeks later, they write home saying that it was examined by many of us and finally laid upon the ground, for we expected to move forward in a short time and it would be impossible to carry it. When they did start back towards camp, they then go on to list who picked up the ball and who carried it this, you know, a little bit away before they gave it to the next person, before they gave it to the next one, because it's heavy. But it's a great story because in the end, it's this, you know, monumental piece of history. You know, I was there at the first battle, if you will, and they really want to send it home so that it can be displayed in the front window of the newspaper in La Crosse. But one of the La Crosse, or one of the Milwaukee newspaper men, Charles King, or I'm sorry, Rufus King, Charles King's father, he actually intercepts it and says, no, we're going to send this to Madison because it needs to be part of the state archive. But he sends it, of course, to his own newspaper headquarters in Milwaukee for display first. But eventually, long story short, it ends up with Myron Gardner's sister, who finally donates it to the state in 1888. But it is a little bit more of one of the more morbid pieces.
And one of the stranger ones, so I want to check out one more. This is from a more recent war. A lighter with an image of Osama bin Laden on it.
Yes, this one was collected by Nora Prohaska. It was actually purchased from her, if you could say it was purchased, in Iraq during her tour in Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom. So really, you know, you're in Baghdad in the spring of 2003 is when she arrives there, and her tour gets extended twice. And so one of the ways that they were able to bring a little bit of normalcy to their life was that they'd have essentially a flea market that they could go visit nearby in the green zone in Baghdad, and you could pick up things like DVDs and things like that for entertainment, but there was also an opportunity to pick up souvenirs. And she picked up a leather fan that had the image of Saddam Hussein on it and a few other items, as well as this very interesting piece, this lighter, like you said, that has Osama bin Laden on it and the Twin Towers. And the story that she has from her oral history really exemplifies how she got it. You know, it wasn't because, obviously, this is a really important moment in American history, but the person who came to the, essentially, to the outside the wire at their base just to sell it was there just to sell anything and everything they could. So they actually, the individual walks up to the wire and says, you know, here to sell, lighter, trade, barter. And her sergeant, who's looking at this, says, do you understand what this even is, what this means? And she says, you know, watching all this, it's this almost just awestruck. Why would you try and sell this to us? This is, you don't know how offensive this even is. But it is that idea that, well, Americans will take, you know, buy whatever they want, whatever they can. So it is something that the sergeant then tells her, or tells the seller, you know, don't ever come back here. You can't sell this to us. But he never doesn't give the lighter back. She holds on to it and keeps it with her, and she actually donates it here to the museum.
Now, Kevin, the exhibit is ready to rock next week. Are you still looking to hear stories from people, current service members, or people with maybe a family story to share?
We certainly are. We're very much still actively collecting. We'd love to have and share stories and photos of all Wisconsin veterans. It's one of my personal goals to have a photograph of every single Wisconsin veteran out there, because I think it's the faces behind the facts or the humanity behind the history that matters. So please consider sharing your story with us.
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Kevin Hampton, curator of history at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. He was with us today to talk about their new exhibit, Souvenirs of Service. It opens next Friday, November 5th. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about building community through architecture.
Arijit Sen is an architecture professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's lived all over the world, from Mumbai, India to Muncie, Indiana. Now, he directs a field school at UWM's Buildings, Landscape, and Cultures program, where he's creating a new model for how universities can work closely with community partners. A podcast from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities called Human Powered talked to Arijit. Here's the show's host, Jimmy Gutierrez.
Almost every architecture program has a field school. It's where students travel around Europe or study famous buildings. But in Arijit's version, students stay in Milwaukee and build something else, community.
The connection to community is a personal search. I went away from where I grew up, and I didn't have a place which I called home. I had people who I called home. What I realized over time is people, places, activities, memories is place, not just the physicality of it.
For the last 6 years or so, Arij has been a regular presence in Washington Park, as well as Sherman Park, Thurston Woods, and other Northside neighborhoods. Through the field school, he has built up a network of residents and students actively working together.
I can come out here and I can start putting flowers out and watering my grass and cutting my grass, and then it's a ripple effect.
Sherry Fuqua has owned her home in the neighborhood for almost 2 decades now. Across the street from Sherry's house are 4 vacant lots in a row, a pretty big piece of land. After years of work, Sherry, with help from the city, transformed it into a park. She wants this park to connect Metcalf and Sherman Park, so she ended up calling it Unity Orchard.
It's just ideal because you'll just see people just come over there and sit, just talk, or have lunch, or the kids over there playing. And other than that, it would just be just vacant paper, bottles, just, you know. But then it's a space like this that you actually, they'll respect the place. And as they see we building on it, just like that mural, you know.
Arij's students have done 2 projects now with Sherry to help develop Unity Orchard even more. First, they made a bunch of planters that doubled as benches. They also built a shed, or maybe it's a trellis, maybe it's a pergola. The idea was that it could collect rainwater for the plants and trees and provide a little shelter. But then the project ran into reality.
This time we had fundraised, we had $1,000, we bought materials for that. They did incredible amount of work. They even put the foundation, and then someone got killed in the neighborhood. And out of respect, we didn't really work on that. So we were hoping that it would be taken over by another person, but then pandemic started. So it sat there, and I was like, okay, it's gone. Well, 2 months ago, 3 of the students came back. They had graduated, they'd gone. They said, can you give me Sherry's number? And that's all they said.
It was sitting in their office over a year, and he actually just called me out of the blue, like, Miss Sherry, how y'all doing over there? Do you think we could come and put the brain catcher up? And I'm like, really, like, I know we don't have to, and I know school is out and we're not doing anything, but me and my guys would love to come and do that for you. You know what I'm saying? I almost cried, real talk. So I'm like, really, because see, it wasn't just his class and his credits that he was looking for. This is beyond. And they've came over here and actually forged relationship with guys. They know the guys. And actually, the guys come out and they help them put it up. And they, it's the realness that you look for. And you, a genuine connection, you'll know it. You'll know.
How we value places in our community is all about perspective. Arij and the Field School tapped into that and ended up building something tangible. It's not just a new model for architecture programs, but it's also a new model for anyone who wants to make places better.
That story came to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we take a look at a proposed state law that would ban white bagging, a practice where insurance companies require hospital patients to get their medications from certain special pharmacies. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the pandemic put the brakes on many young people moving into adulthood. Milestones were missed, opportunities to socialize and celebrate shut down. But a lot of teens have refused to press pause and use this time to pave a new path. You'll hear their stories about moving into adulthood in their own words. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a new bill from the state legislature seeks to ban an insurance company practice known as white bagging. White bagging is when an insurance company dictates specific pharmacies that patients must go to in order to get certain medications, especially those used in ongoing hospital treatments. The practice often affects patients with complex health problems like cancer. The proposed bill called Corrine's Law argues that this practice prevents patients from getting life-saving medication. Sometimes hospitals don't allow patients to get their drugs from outside pharmacies that their insurance companies are pointing them to, forcing patients to choose between paying out-of-pocket for hospital-approved drugs or finding care elsewhere. Joanne Ellig is the Senior Vice President of Public Policy at the Wisconsin Hospital Association, which supports that bill. Joanne, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, this is, I think, under the radar for a lot of people, for me included. Can you spell out a little more an example of how this white bagging practice would work for a patient?
Yeah, sure. So first, I think, you know, your introduction was great. And we are talking about medications for patients who have, say, cancer or rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis. So let's say you're one of those patients and you have to go into your doctor's office or your clinic or to a cancer center to get an infusion. Right now, I think patients don't really think about where do those medications come from. And typically, they're coming right from the provider's office, right from your hospital, the hospital's pharmacy. And what this practice does is it would say, okay, well, your provider can't use their own supply anymore from their pharmacy. They have to use the one that the insurer designates. And why should patients care? Well, it can cause delays. They might have to reschedule their treatment. And so it's really suddenly patients are having to know, where does my medication come from? And in Corrine's case, and Corrine is who the legislation is named after, mm-hmm. her hospital has said, we can't accept white bag medications. And so she was faced with either paying out of pocket or having to find a whole new care treatment team. So in the middle of her cancer treatment.
Why would a hospital say we won't take these medications from a legally licensed pharmacy?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think that one is some of the stories that we hear about in terms of the drugs not being delivered on time, they get damaged in shipping, hospitals being sent the wrong dose. And really, the hospitals feel like they can't control and they don't have the ability to really track and trace. They don't know where that medication has been through the entire process. We have stories of mail carriers dropping off shipments at a counter or at a wrong address, and you can't be sure that the medication has been kept at the right temperature, at the right humidity, at the right light. These are sort of special medications that need particular kind of care and handling. And so they're very concerned about the safety with these medications.
Now, a group of insurers and pharmacies who are opposing Corrine's law put out a press release saying, hey, this could be a cost saver. And I'm going to quote here. They say white bagging can protect patients from a hospital's markup for prescribed drugs, which on average runs between 200 to 400%, they say, of the hospital's acquisition cost. So maybe there's some inconveniences there, but it could be a big money saver ultimately. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, actually, our patient advocates have reported that patients actually can end up paying more in co-payments. If the hospital doesn't accept the white bag medication, the patient can pay full out-of-network cost and out-of-their-pocket for this. And really, I think if excessive reimbursements is the problem that they want to address, they can do that through negotiation, through their contracts with providers. But these policies are being implemented outside of the contract. They really interrupt that provider and patient care treatment plan. And so there are ways to address that, but this practice really isn't the way.
And this, some of the big providers say this isn't new, but it really seemed to kick into high gear just in the last couple of years with major insurance providers making this shift, whether it's a brand new policy or amping up an old one, right? This is something that's happening more and more often?
Right, yeah. And it's a little surprising, actually, given everything that hospitals are facing during COVID and just really trying to make sure that they're continuing to provide that high quality care to patients. And we have found, yeah, that a few insurance companies announced their policy changes this year. And so that really did raise the visibility of the practice. And so that's, I think, why we're kind of starting to engage in this.
So we're going to call her. Therese is with us in Green Bay. Therese, hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I know this has been briefly discussed in the beginning. I worked for a national health insurer, for 34 years. This practice has actually been going on a while, and the reason insurance companies want to get involved in this is there's significant markup when these specialty drugs come from the doctor's office or directly from the hospital. There's a big profit being made off of the way the supply chain used to work. And insurance companies, believe it or not, have a bad reputation, but they're trying to save patients money. And specialty pharmacy, a lot of national insurers and even local have put in programs to make sure the things that your guest is saying about temperature and right conditions and delivery all work well. So this is not new, this system, and it has not had a lot of problems. Of course,
gotcha, Teresa. We're just about out of time. Joanne, are healthcare providers just protecting a revenue source here?
No, I would say again, if they think that reimbursement's the problem, then we should do that, take care of that through negotiation. I would say that the study that you referenced really kind of cherry picks the drugs, and the way that contracting has changed over the last several years really has sort of addressed many of those concerns. Ultimately, we believe that patients just shouldn't be put in the middle. And so I also, before we run out of time, would love to put a plug in for patientsfirstwisconsin.com. That's where you can find more information.
Joanne, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Joanne Alleg is Senior Vice President of Public Policy at the Wisconsin Hospital Association. She joined us to discuss her organization's support of a law that would ban the practice we've been talking about called white bagging. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a lot of people provide care to family members with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. The author of a new book shares lots of advice and resources and comfort for caregivers. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then congressional Democrats say they're close to nailing down a framework package to address climate change, child care, and much more. We'll take a closer look and talk about the latest ideas on how to pay for those plans. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's electoral maps have changed the balance of power in our legislature and congressional delegation. In turn, that's changed policy. In this week's episode of the WPR podcast, Mapped Out, we look at how district lines impacted union rights, education funding, and more. First, the clock is ticking on Democrats' efforts to pass key parts of President Joe Biden's domestic economic agenda. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi set the latest deadline for the bipartisan infrastructure package at the end of this month, less than 5 days away. But moderate and progressive Democrats still haven't reached agreements on key elements of the party's social safety net package, slowing down progress on both proposals. It's the week in Washington. We'll find out what's in, what's out, and how Democrats want to pay for their plan to increase social spending. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support a smaller, more scaled-back version of the social safety net package, though still big? Do you want to see policies that address climate change as part of it? How about a child tax credit extension? Would less expensive childcare help you and your family? And hey, how about paying for it all? Do you want to see tax increases? If so, on who? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill covering House leadership. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Good to be back with you.
What is the latest, Scott, on negotiations between House leadership, Democratic leaders, and the rank and file of their party trying to come to votes on these packages?
Well, it feels a little bit like Groundhog Day. I mean, they keep saying that they're close, that they have, 90% of it done, and yet each day that passes, there's still no deal, and today is much the same. We are approaching, a couple deadlines here. Joe Biden leaves for Europe tomorrow, and so he for a big climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland. He'll also meet with the Pope, probably to talk about climate issues, among other things. And so he wants to have a deal in hand, and he has basically begged Democrats to come up with a deal before he takes that trip overseas on this big social spending and climate package. And so their meetings continue. He met with two key senators, Senators Manchin of West Virginia and Sinema of Arizona last night. He's had some House members over to the Oval Office yesterday as well. There are talks continuing to happen in the Capitol where I am currently. So there are signs of progress, but as of now, there's still no deal that has been clinched.
A big change is the size of the social safety net, the human infrastructure package, as the Biden administration called it at some points, down from something like $3.5 trillion over 10 years to $1.8, $1.9-ish over 10 years, depending on the latest details. What kind of things have dropped out to bring that price tag down?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big ones was a big priority for President Biden and a number of progressives up on Capitol Hill. Free community college for 2 years is out of the package. We know that for sure. Biden has indicated that in private meetings as well as publicly in a recent town hall. The other big key issue that is out is $150 billion for a clean energy program that had really been a centerpiece of his green energy initiatives. And so there are other efforts to combat climate change that will be in this package. What's emerging right now is about $500 billion for initiatives to take on climate change. That's what he wants to be able to bring over to this international climate summit, which starts October 31st, next week. He wants to be able to make a big speech on that stage and say, look, this is what America is doing to combat climate change. Other nations need to be doing the same. If he goes empty-handed, he is arguing to Democrats that that's going to be a huge embarrassment for the country and for the administration.
There's been a lot of focus also on proposals aimed at helping parents in this spending bill, things like child care accessibility, child tax credits. Where are those as the overall package gets pared down?
Yeah, what we know is, Nancy Pelosi has a 90% of this package is complete and basically signed off on. Of course, it's that 10% that is proving to be the toughest part of the negotiations. But we do know that pre-kindergarten will be in there. That was a huge priority for not only educators, but also progressives, as well as more funding to help people with childcare, as well as with elder care as they take care of their aging parents. One issue that has been scaled back and really trimmed down is that child tax credit. Families in Wisconsin and other places may have noticed that they're receiving hundreds of dollars each month to help, offset the high costs of just having children. And so that is known as the child tax credit. That was part of that CARES Act that passed the Congress earlier that funded a child tax credit for 1 year. Well, in this next package, they're looking to extend that child tax credit. They had hoped to do it permanently. That was really the wish list of the progressives. But it looks like because of demands from some of these moms like Manchin and Sinema, that will really be pared down to only a 1 year extension. So a bit of a disappointment for progressives who had really hoped that they would be able to permanently extend that child tax credit and give American families a boost in their bank accounts each month.
Talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. And this week, as with many recent weeks, that means the two spending bills, the infrastructure one, the social spending and climate change one, still getting closer, still not done yet. You can share your thoughts on what's in them, how to pay for them at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. So I'd like to see both bills scrapped, jettisoned entirely. Washington is completely reckless with the money that they collect. why would we keep giving more money to a drunken sailor who will just blow it at port?
Mike, thanks for the call. And Scott, a lot of Republicans in Congress, I think, would like to see both of those bills scrapped or significantly pared back. What are we hearing from opponents of the packages, not just bits of them, but opponents of the, especially the social spending package?
Yeah, definitely. That is a comment we're hearing from a lot of Republicans who are concerned with the nation's debt crisis, that are concerned with too much spending in Washington. You know, we had thought initially that the infrastructure bill would be able to capture, you know, dozens and dozens of Republican votes on the House side, as it did pretty well among Republicans on the Senate side. But the longer that these negotiations have been drawn out, the longer that Joe Biden has said that these two bills must pass the Congress together, that has really turned off a lot of Republicans from that infrastructure bipartisan bill. And so we're expecting really only a handful of Republicans at the end of the day to join all the Democrats to pass it. And absolutely zero Republicans will support the much larger social spending package. Republicans see that as really, you know, opposition to that bill as really a good campaign issue to campaign on ahead of the 2022 election.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Michael now in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I really just have sort of a two-part comment. There are just kind of two things that I don't understand, not about the bill, but just as a progressive and generally Democratic voter, I find myself incredibly frustrated with Manchin and Sinema, and I don't understand why they won't get on board with the rest of the Democrats to pass things. And I guess the other thing that I don't understand, which is more a direct comment on the bill, is why why Republicans will support things that bills like tax cuts when they're so concerned about the debt, but they won't support spending that will help millions and millions of Americans, things that will help millions of Americans far more than some tax cuts, and they're suddenly concerned with the cost.
Mike, thanks for the call. Or Michael, thanks for the call. Scott, Michael's first point, he's probably not alone among progressives who consider themselves Democrats in frustration with Senators Manchin and Sinema.
Yeah, in fact, I was just talking to some progressives today, Jamal Bowman of New York City, as well as some others who were expressing exactly that frustration with Manchin and Sinema. You know, it's been months and months of negotiations, and they believe that every time they sort of reach agreement on an issue, you know, they move the goalpost or they bring up another issue that they're opposed to, and it's sort of, you know, whack-a-mole, and there's no real resolution to it. And so, you know, if you ask Manchin would say that he's representing West Virginia values, West Virginia voters. He says they want, you know, fiscal responsibility. Obviously, he represents coal country in West Virginia and therefore has been opposed to a lot of the energy initiatives that the Biden administration has been putting forward. And so, you know, this is the political reality that the Democrats are facing right now. They only have 50 senators, and they need every single one in order to pass anything. And so that is why these two senators, the centrist senators, the ones that are causing some trouble for the rest of the Democratic Party, are getting so much attention, not only from the media, but from the president himself. I mean, they are over at the White House meeting with the president, meeting with his top staff almost every other day. And that's because they absolutely need these two senators on board if any piece of the agenda is going to pass the Congress.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Scott Wong. He covers House leadership for The Hill. He's with us for our weekly look at the top stories in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we've looked at some of the spending side of these bills in Congress. We'll look at the revenue side, calls to increase taxes, especially on the wealthiest Americans, or bump up corporate minimum tax rates. Love to hear what you think of either or both of those ideas. Call in at 800-642-1234. Would you support those kind of tax increases in general to help pay for these particular packages, or do you worry they might be counterproductive? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Scott Wong is with us, senior staff writer at The Hill. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the infrastructure and the human service and climate change packages in Congress right now. What do you think of what they spend money on and how they raise money? Join in at 800-642-1234. Scott, one of the latest ideas, something like a wealth tax to help pay for part of the cost here, the social spending package. We talked about that on the show yesterday. I want to give a listen to Democratic Senator Joe Manchin talking about the idea of any kind of taxes, focusing on billionaires in particular. He's speaking yesterday here at the Economic Club of Washington, D.C.
The way we're moving pretty soon, anybody's not a millionaire, don't worry. We're not fooling with you at all. We're going to get all these people up here. That's not America.
So Manchin saying these wealth tax-like ideas divisive. What's the latest on the revenue side, Scott?
Yeah, if you remember, the reason we're in this position is because Senator Sinema originally said she was opposed to tax hikes on the wealthy and to corporations. So tax writers went back to the drawing board. They came up with this new idea, a tax on billionaires, as people in the Capitol have been calling it, a billionaire's tax. Well, you know, that would tax billionaires, basically profits that billionaires make each year on their stocks, not necessarily capital gains when they sell it, but it would be an annual tax on any sort of, money that they make. And Manchin has decided to pour cold water on that idea as well, saying he just doesn't like the idea of taxing, you know, a specific group of people. In this case, that group of people are about 700 billionaires, but he doesn't like a targeted tax going after, you know, individual people. Obviously, it's driven progressives absolutely crazy. They've been after taxing billionaires for quite a while and having them pay what they call their fair share. So this is now the second iteration where the tax writers are going back to the drawing board, and now they're really going to have to start getting creative to figure out how they're going to pay for the package, given that President Biden has said he wants it fully paid for.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Number one, I'd like to say it's great that you have a guest from The Hill as a news maven. I find The Hill one of the more unbiased and very fair reporting out there. So sure enjoy having someone from The Hill available. I'd also like to say just in general that for the billionaires tax is that several years ago, the state of Maryland proposed a millionaires tax. They would only tax the millionaires to get rid of the deficit in Maryland. But the Maryland millionaires ended up moving so that they ended up decreasing the wealthy person's tax base in Maryland and actually making the situation worse. A billionaire is going to figure out how to shelter that income, and it's only going to hurt in the long run if you target them, as Joe Manchin is trying to prevent. Thank you so much, and good luck.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Scott, is that an argument that's been brought up, the idea that we might drive out billionaires or just move them into different ways to shelter their money from a new kind of tax?
First of all, I'd like to thank the caller for reading The Hill, and we try to be straight shooters at The Hill and play it right down the middle. On his comments about the billionaires or even a millionaires tax in Maryland, where I live, that has been a concern, is that, you know, these billionaires, they certainly have the money to the best tax minds. They will try to, you know, find other loopholes to evade
paying taxes. And that certainly is something that is being discussed in the Capitol. You know, that you know, these guys will be able to find other ways to be able to hang on to their money. And so I think that is something that lawmakers are looking at very closely as they're writing this legislation. I mean, the problem is, of course, that they're trying to do this in a hurry, pressure not only from you know, the media, but President Biden himself, and they're trying to get a deal and get this wrapped up quickly while also trying to write very, very complicated tax policy and try to consider all the different scenarios that could happen, you know, based on that legislation.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. We'll go to Dan now in Franksville. Dan, hi.
Yeah, I don't think we have to worry about politicians with making decisions, because you know, didn't the railroads pretty much run the country back in the late 1800s? And how much money is actually being passed around there? I mean, to worry, you just give them a bill with a check. I mean, that's what ALEC was all about, I guess. American Legislative Exchange Committee is just, I mean, if you want to get elected, you have to get money. I mean, the system seems rigged even back in the 1800s.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, Dan worried about the influence, I think, of money and maybe lobbying on political negotiations over something like these spending bills. Is that something that people have been raising as a concern here?
Well, as you know, Rob, we're talking about over the course of this year, trillions of dollars in spending that either has been passed through the coronavirus relief or is being considered through the infrastructure package and this human infrastructure package. And so that, of course, attracts, you know, numerous lobbyists to these issues. And many of those lobbyists are working overtime to ensure their issues are being addressed. And so just to give you an example, you know, it looks like dental coverage will be out of any sort of Medicare expansion proposal in this Build Back Better plan. It's entirely possible that dental, vision, and hearing will all be scrapped and that there will be no Medicare expansion. That's one of the things on the table. And the dental lobby was really pushing hard to ensure that dental was not included in this Medicare expansion. The dentists themselves believe that their argument was that the paperwork and the bureaucracy would be too onerous for them to have to deal with Medicare. And so that's just one example of a special interest, in this case, the dentist and the dental lobby, finding success in trying to change this legislation. And that's happening across the board with many different issues.
Thanks for that call. In our last minute or so, Scott, what are you watching for next on all these issues?
Well, to see if they can get something done in these next sort of 48 hours, really a critical period. It's not only Biden going to Glasgow, Scotland for this climate summit. There's an election on Tuesday in Virginia in the governor's race between Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat, and Glenn Youngkin, the Republican. And, you know, Democrats want to have some kind of momentum. They want to have a couple victories heading into that election day. Right now, there's just a lot of infighting in the party and a lot of frustration. That's not a good place to be if you're Terry McAuliffe. And Democrats want, you know, that's going to be a bellwether election for how the rest of the 2022 cycle goes. And Democrats would love to be able to hold on to the governor's mansion in Virginia, you know, really something that has been a red state that turned purple and now is considered a blue state. If it were to go back to the Republicans, that would set a strong signal that Republicans have enormous momentum in 2022.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob. Take care.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, covering House leadership. He was with us today for a weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, we'll hear the latest episode of the WPR Mapped Out podcast and find out how Wisconsin's election maps changed the direction of the state over the last decade, especially when it comes to important policy decisions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.